Hi, I'm Bella Gandhi, founder of Smart Dating Academy and your host of this beautiful podcast. We're here to bring more love into your life, regardless of if you're single, if you're married, if you're thinking about becoming single, if you're thinking about becoming married or finding the lid to your pot. And we're going to bring more life into that love that you have or you want. You might have seen me on Good Morning America or Steve Harvey or the Today Show or 100 other places, but I'm so happy that you are here with us because we're going to make your life and your love better. Smart daters, welcome back to this week's podcast. I am jumping out of my skin, excited to bring you my new friend, an amazing, super industrial rock star, Vienna Farron. Vienna, welcome to the Smart Dating Academy podcast.
New friends. I love it. We're quick friends. I'm so excited to be here and to chat with you. Thank you for having me.
Okay. For those of you who might not know, which I can't imagine you don't know her, but Vienna, trained at Northwestern. She's partially Chicago, so we talked about that, but is a licensed marriage and family therapist and one of New York City's most sought after relationship therapists. She's got an amazing Instagram, Mindful MFT. She's a TikTok star. Vienna, so happy to have you here. Let's dive right in to wounds, dating, friendships, relationships, all of it. Tell us about you.
Yeah. Well, a lot of times people will ask me like how I got into this work, right? And that's probably a good place for us to start because it's probably unsurprising that my own life story brought me into the work of becoming a couples therapist, a family therapist, right? Someone who is really intrigued and interested in what goes into making relationships work. I grew up in a divorced household. My parents went through a 9-year divorce process, which at the time was the record, you know, in the state of New Jersey. It was a really long, drawn out process.
Wow, 9 years.
Yeah. Really, really long. I know that amount of time has been surpassed at this point. But I was a kiddo. I was in first grade when the separation started. And that was a really long time to be going through it. And obviously really important years of my life to be experiencing and bearing witness to something that was really challenging. You know, there was a lot of chaos. There was a lot of conflict. There was a lot of gaslighting and manipulation and psychological abuse and paranoia and emotional flooding. And I always share that I'm an only child as well. And the reason I share that detail is because I was this individual kiddo in a family system going through this. And I think, you know, this idea of if I had had a sibling or neither one of my parents repartnered, or if I had had another adult in this space who could have like understood the experience or connected with it or validated something, I think that would have been a really different and interesting experience for me versus one where just as a kiddo, I'm sitting there watching, experiencing, observing, and trying to make sense of everything that was going on without really having someone else in the space to witness, you know, to really bear witness to what was going on and really connect with what my experience was. I became someone.
Just wow.
Yeah, it was a lot. I know it really was. I mean, obviously the work that I do now is reconnecting with, you know, these younger parts of the self. And so there's a real tender spot there for her. But when I was a kid watching, I would say like the adults were crashing and burning around me. And as a kiddo, I decided that my best option was to fly under the radar, was to become needless. I became really good at the things that I put my mind to. And that was my coping strategy, right? That was my way of protecting myself and to some degree, really protecting them. I was an it's fine girl. I'm good girl. Nothing bothers me girl, which turned me into a it's fine woman. I'm good woman. Nothing bothers me woman. The persona was the cool girl. You know, I was unaffected by everything. I was boundaryless. And I thought that that was the least disruptive way to operate in the world. And I share that, right? Because when we look at those early years and understand the roles that we took on and understand, you know, you mentioned the word wounding. Obviously, I talk a lot about wounding in my book, but, you know, it was like who I became as an adult woman was such an extension of that. Again, not surprising, but there's so much value to being able to connect and really comprehend our story so that we can start to create change. Because the reality of it was, is that my romantic relationships, my friendships, right? Like there were limitations and constraints and blocks there that kept me from having the relationships in life that I really desired because I couldn't speak up. I didn't know how to have boundaries. I pretended like I was fine. I had no relationship with my voice whatsoever. And I really needed personally to dive into this work that I write about now in order to do, you know, the healing that was necessary to shift from disempowered to empowered, to move from survival to choice. Right? Like that to me is such a huge part of the healing process, is reclaiming a relationship with choice and actually sort of sitting in the driver's seat of our lives. So, little personal background there as to why I got into this space.
That's amazing. I mean, what a story. And you became the cool girl and to some extent the peacemaker and to some extent the one who performed and did all of the things correctly, which makes so much sense. At what point do you remember or think that you became aware of, oh shit, my parents' divorce actually impacted who I am? Because I think so often we just forget that and we lose sense of that. Did you have like that inflection point moment where you're like, oh my God, and the light bulb went on?
Well, let me tell you, I was really stubborn for a long time. Even when I went to grad school to become a marriage and family therapist, while I was in school, I was like, my parents' divorce didn't affect me. My parents are great friends. We spend holidays together. And that was true, right? There was an evolution to their relationship in which they had become pretty good friends. They would come to my lacrosse games together. I remember teammates of mine in my senior year of college were like, wait, your parents are divorced? You know, it struck me that they didn't present in that way to the world at that point in my life, right? And so like, yeah, they're great friends. They travel in the car together. We have holidays together now. Everything's good, right? And and I just held that story that I wasn't affected. There wasn't anything to see here. And I share that because I think so many of us can be resistant to the idea that the past does indeed impact us, or that it maybe has still some type of hold on us decades later. A lot of times people are resistant to doing this work of turning back around. They're like, one, what am I going to find in Pandora's box? Or two, I'm in a place now with the relationship with them that's good and I don't want to tamper with it. Or three, you know, they did the best that they could. Or four, they were so much better than their parents were to them, so I should just be grateful. Or five, they've given up so much and sacrificed so much, and so I would feel foolish to, you know, complain about something. And this work is not about going on a wild goose hunt. We're not trying to chase something down. We're not trying to stay stuck in the past, but we are trying to acknowledge and honor the story, right? To acknowledge and honor the pain, to acknowledge and honor the wounds. And it didn't really, I wasn't ready to fully see it probably until my mid late 20s. There's a catalyst. Certainly, I was dating someone whose ex came back into the picture, and he was trying to figure out whether or not he wanted to be back in the relationship with her, stay in the relationship with me. And he and I were monogamous. We were dating at the time, and you know, it's fine, of course, I totally understand, yada-da-da-da, right? Like both the pleaser, the peacekeeper, the it's fine girl is showing up, and also a little bit of the therapist who holds context for everyone is showing up too, right? Because I'm like, there's a story here.
He's got trauma. And I need to hold space for his trauma.
So here I am holding all of this space for this person, which also, right, like there was truth to it. There was a lot of complicated layers to it that I did understand. But I remember having a conversation with a friend at one point, and the light bulb did go off. I was like, oh, yeah, this is the same role that I've been in my entire life. And it really linked to, you know, obviously my early childhood and the story that I was sharing before. And it's funny how resistant we can be. One could argue, didn't you go to grad school for this? You're like, you got a degree in this. Like, what happened?
You're right, like, it was to heal my own wounds. Right, come on. Right?
And, you know, and I had done, there, you know, being in grad school for this work, it's like being in therapy for a couple of years, right? It's like, it's deep, it's intensive. And there was still beautiful work that did get accomplished, and I could also lead clients to a certain point. But I'm also a big believer that our own resolution as individuals and in the role as therapist, right, is such a huge part in where we can take our clients. And I really needed to continue to do this work in order to be able to lead clients and push them and guide them and challenge them to go further as well. And so, yeah, there was that catalyst where the light bulb moment went off. I had the aha, and I think I really just surrendered to the fact that I had been affected. And it might seem obvious to some folks, but if you're a I'm fine person, the moment that you say I'm not fine for the first time really is life changing.
Yeah.
And it might sound really simple, but it's this pivot. And I talk about that in the book, right? It's like this pivot where we get off of the, you know, the tracks in the snow that are pre-made, right? If you go cross-country skiing, let's say, right? It's like, oh, this is easy. I can do this. The tracks are already here. It's the moment that you jump out of that into fresh powder and so much harder, right? It's so much more challenging. And yeah, I mean, it was a deeply confronting moment when I called him up and said, I'm going to take myself out of the equation. And it's not actually fine. And it has felt really disrespectful. And I'm not okay with what's going on. And this wasn't a mic drop moment. This wasn't a, oh, I feel so empowered now. This was a deeply distressing moment, you know, like curled up on the bathroom floor, crying. There was contraction that happened after a moment of expansion, which I think is really important for us to know that often after we take these moments of expansion in our lives, where we communicate something that we previously wouldn't communicate, where we set a boundary when we normally wouldn't have set a boundary, right? Where we do the thing that we're working and practicing, that it doesn't always feel great. In fact, a lot of the time it doesn't feel great at all. And that doesn't mean that you're on the wrong path, right? The contraction is just like, oh, it almost feels like death sometimes. I don't mean that dramatically, but like, ooh, wow. I'm still here and I survived it, but ooh, I don't feel great.
It's so funny that you say that, because in the work that we do at Smart Dating Academy, when we have singles that have come in and they have chronically, you know, I call it like our pickers are broken, right? And it's not because we're broken. It's we were never taught how to date and find good, healthy, happy relationships. So when we're guiding them, and if somebody has thrown down red flags, we've given it a second chance, they continue, right? There's some... it becomes easy, not even easy to your point. We'll teach them how to use their voice and say, hey, you know what? When you said such and such, it made me realize that we're not on the same page. You know, I am sure you'll find someone else. Have a nice life. I'm kidding. That's not what we have them say. But they feel really proud in the moment. But to your point, sometimes there's, I call it a backpedaling, but I like the contraction. It's, oh my God, did I just do the wrong thing? That person was really, I think that person was great. We're like, they're not great. So it becomes this moment of second guessing, contracting. Yeah. And so our job is, no, you're good. You used your voice. You took control. You set a boundary. Mm-hmm. Your standard was here and you stopped accepting that.
Yeah. When we create change, it requires us to tolerate discomfort. And that's one of the hardest pieces, is that our ability to tolerate disappointing someone, letting someone down, upsetting someone, right? Whatever it might be, fill in the blank, right? It has to increase. And that's hard. That's hard when we are pleasers. That's hard when we have a worthiness wound in the driver's seat, where the most important thing in our world is that someone chooses us, that we're not checking in with ourselves, that nothing else really matters, just as long as this person wants to be with me, right? Whatever it might be. I mean, there's endless storylines, but our ability to tolerate something is hard, because to create change or to step from, you know, disempowerment to empowerment, there really is a consequence to it, if you will. There's also a victory, but we don't see the victory in the moment as much.
Right.
The consequence is, oh, this relationship ends, or I have to put a stop to something, or someone is going to be disappointed in me. And that is something that so many of us have lived our lives doing everything in our power to avoid. And so when we're asking ourselves to step towards that, you can understand why the system is like, "Ooh, no, thank you. I don't think I want to do that. It doesn't get me the outcome that I want."
Right. And the outcome for so many people, to your point, is, well, I want to get the third date, and I want to get the fourth date, and I want to get the fifth date. I'm like, this is not a performance that you're being graded on. I want you to stop and think about, how did I feel when I was on this date? Like, you have the steering wheel of your dating life. No one else does. But for so long, we have exited the driver's seat and sat in the passenger seat, right? It's like, I want you to say yes. I'm like, no, you don't. You don't have to. So it's, how do I feel? And using your voice to make sure that you're picking people that feel really good and really safe for you.
Yeah. Yeah. But the picker, you know, the picker can be skewed when we have irresolution.
Oh, good. Let's go there, girl.
Yeah. Right. Because I think, you know, when we talk about, like, yeah, you're not broken, but you might be unresolved around something, right? And your picker goes towards that which is familiar a lot of the time. Sometimes it'll go to opposition, which might appear to be pretty nice on the surface, but opposition isn't actually integration. So sometimes you'll see people in dating where they like date one type and then they swing the pendulum all, you know, it's like the nasty kind of jerk over here, and then the like super duper nice, like really kind of, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, whether it's the nice person, the overgiving person, the this, and then they go back and forth between the two, right? And so, yeah, our pickers really need resolution in order for us to actually choose differently in the moment, because otherwise we're going to be operating from a fear-based place, right? From a protective place. And to understand what it is that we're actually trying to protect in a dating process, let's say, it is a really important question for us to be asking.
So, and I know you could probably talk for 10 hours about this, because this is amazing. I mean, how do we, if we feel like our pickers are off and we're listening to this going, oh my God, this sounds like me, how do we begin this work?
Your pattern recognition is really important. So within the context of dating, if dating hasn't been working out for you, if relationships haven't been working out for you in the way that you want, we really want to understand what the pattern is. I always say the unwanted patterns in our lives are pointing us to the irresolution from the past. And so, okay, gentleness here, because I'm going to remind us of that in this inquiry, in our curiosity. We are moving shame aside. We're moving self-criticism aside. We're moving guilt and embarrassment aside. And we're just trying to bring some compassion and grace and curiosity forward. We have to go on this quest together, right? And so, yeah, our unwanted patterns, which, by the way, if you're human, you've got them. It's like, so let's just normalize that right off the bat, right?
We
like,
all have them. Say it again for the people in the back.
It's like, we all got them. So no shame there. And also, you might be a little tired of yourself. You know, the reality of it is like, I know that frustrated feeling where you're like, oh, again, like I keep doing the thing that I promise and say that I'm not going to do. So again, curiosity, right? Because our choices, our behaviors, the things that we are frustrated about, the unwanted patterns that keep poking their heads up, they are trying to protect us from something. And I think that's a beautiful way to approach this as opposed to just being annoyed and frustrated by it. So unwanted patterns, direct line into irresolution. So you want to understand, what's the unwanted pattern that I keep entertaining, that I keep finding myself in? And what is it pointing to? So in the book, I talk about 5 origin wounds, which are worthiness, belonging, prioritization, trust, and safety. Through the work, I'm certain that we all probably rub up against a worthiness wound at some point in our lives. But worthiness wounds are so deeply connected and correlated with conditional love. So if you grew up in a family system where love, connection, attachment, validation, affirmation, peace, calm, etc., were conditional based upon your performance, your perfectionism, your ability to please, right? That might look like straight A's. That might look like scoring a hat trick on the sports field. That might look like being the comic relief in the family. That might look like making mom happy. That might look like, right? I mean, so many different things where you learn that if I am this way, right, then love is available to me. Then communication is available to me. I share when I was a quote unquote good girl, my dad was so lovely and wonderful and helpful and supportive. When I stepped out of good girl mode, punishment through silent treatment was what would play out. And it's just an interesting thing to name, because it was an added layer on top of the I'm fine, I'm unaffected, I'm unbothered, I'm good over here. On top of it was, okay, only if you show up in the way that is okay for him, will you have access to him, his love, his help, his support, et cetera. But once you are slightly difficult, and slightly, because I was a pretty good kid, to be honest, right? It's like, it felt very reasonable for age appropriate, let's say. then it was withdrawn. Right. Then there was a punishment. And now I don't get love, connection, help, support, et cetera. And so you think about, like, as kiddos, when we are going through things like that, how that sets the foundation and framework for us. Don't be difficult, Vienna, because when you're difficult, it means that people will disappear. It means that you're not going to get the care, love, attention, support that you want. And so as long as you just keep pretending, as long as you keep just performing, then you can create the illusion for yourself that everything is okay and everything is fine. So, you know, that worthiness wound, I think so many people can
relate. Massive.
I saw your hand go up. So.
My hand went up for those of you who aren't watching the video. So, I mean, my parents are immigrants from India. Yeah. Okay. So I don't have to go through this.
Yes, we don't have to
You need to get the straight A's. You need to do, you can be this or this. You can be a doctor or a lawyer, and I'm a dating coach. And so there's lots of things that go into that worthiness wound, and you realize it. And I know you've got a little one and one on the way. When you're a parent, you're like, oh, okay, you need to get good grades. Wait, am I messing them up?
right. Well, it's interesting, right? Because I was just having this conversation with my husband, as yes, we have a 3-year-old, we have one on the way, and we're like, okay, obviously we don't want them to experience trauma. That would be really nice, right? Like we're right. Like as parents, we're like, okay, how do we protect these sweet angels in the world? And also we know, and I know you've had Dr. Ali on before. She says, our gifts and our wounds, our pain, our next door neighbors. And I love that soundbite, because what is so true is that so much of who we are, the gift, the skill set, the asset, right, comes from the pain, right? Yeah. It's birthed from it. I can tell you that I can listen to people's stories and remember every single detail so easily, so well. And that's a skill set as a therapist. But it was birthed from having to watch a father, who at the time was very manipulative, gaslit my mom. I was the observer of this constantly. And survival and safety meant being able to track every single detail so perfectly in order to know what was true and what was not true. She struggled to be able to track it. I was the one who became hypervigilant in that space and was like catching him when
detective Vienna.
Totally. Right. And like, you know, it's so you see, oh gosh, that came from this traumatic wounding experience for you. And also here is this skill set that you now embody as an adult. Now, going back to what my husband and I have been chatting about is like, okay, so can people meet excellence, right, without having to go through something terribly painful, terribly traumatic? And I think where I've ended up, at least for right now, is that there's a difference between something that's contained versus something that's chaotic, that we can go through initiations, that we can meet our edge, that we can be pushed to an edge, but that we can do that either safely or not safely at all. And I think for so many of us, it happens in a non-safe way. And, you know, I think that just that piece of like, ugh, our kiddos, right? It's like, yeah, how do we want to protect them? And we also want to encourage them to meet their edge and to push and to find something that they love or are inspired by or they're excellent at, et cetera. But to how to do it in a contained way and a way that, maybe is more of an initiation than a chaotic, painful, scary experience. Amen. I took us off somewhere for, I don't know where, what the original question was, but no. I veered us down some path.
No, the veering came from me as the mother of two teenagers. It's like the inside musings that we have, like, yeah, my parents and this. And then when you are a parent, it's like, oh my gosh, am I doing that to them? It's like, at a certain point, I've gotten into, listeners, you know, I have a 16-year-old and a 20-year-old, Jade and Max, and I've gotten into acceptance. Like, I'm sure I'm going, like, the three negative things I've said are going to be the ones that stick in their heads, right? So all I can do now, I'm like, so have I given you any bad messages that you carry with you? How can I love you better, right? Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, here we go again. I'm like, okay.
But that's the beauty. I mean, when parents ask, you know, what can we do? That's it. And even if our teenagers roll their eyes at us or tell us to like, just all like the hit time. The road, you know, it's like,
I hate the way you breathe.
Right. It's like, it does great. We'll take that. But for them to hear and know that you are thinking about this, that you're willing to have that conversation, that you have the capacity to repair, you know, one of the greatest things that we can offer children is a willingness to repair, a willingness to take ownership, a willingness to take accountability. I work with adults, but adults who were all children at one point, and everyone just wants acknowledgement. And a lot of the time we're not going to get that, you know, there's going to be a blockage there. But I think for the parents who are, you know, either parents now raising children or thinking about raising children, people are like, how do you make sure that you don't screw up your kids? And they're like, oh, you're going to get so much wrong. You're going to say so many things that you wish you could take back. You're going to try to limit that, of course, but you're not going to operate in this perfect system. And your ability to hold yourself in high enough regard as a human being where you don't need to self-protect when someone says I'm hurt, when someone says I'm disappointed, when someone says you've let me down. When you can hold yourself up and you don't need to self-protect, then you're able to relationally protect, which means that you're able to hear the story and experience of someone else, whether that be your child, your partner, whomever. And that switch from self-protection only to relational protection, which, mind you, relational protection includes you too. So it doesn't mean all of a sudden you're not being self-protected, but to go from only self-protection to relational protection that says, I can tolerate, I have the capacity to hear you without needing to protect and defend myself, without needing to explain it away, without needing to give you the context, right? That's one of the greatest gifts. And so if we're doing that as parents or as partners, we're doing a pretty good job.
Let the eye rolls come from the teenager.
Happen.
Shut up, shut up, shut up. You know, I hate you this, da, 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 da. It's okay. Because at some point they will be so grateful for the acknowledgement, the recognition, the opening, the ability to repair, even if they don't take it at this point.
I love that. So we talked, I love what you said a couple of minutes ago about one of the most important things we can do in dating, for example, mm-hmm. is that recognition of patterns.
Yeah.
Right. And so let's say, dear listeners, driving, taking a walk around Lake Michigan, wherever he or she or they are at this point, and they're like, yeah, I think I do have a pattern. Maybe I'm constantly dating people that are avoidant, or they break my heart, or I'm missing cues that, you know, they're behaving in a narcissistic way. What does someone do as part of the next step after self-awareness?
Yeah. So, okay, let's say you date someone who's avoidant, you're pursuing someone who is emotionally unavailable, and you keep going after it. We want to understand what that choice is serving. And what I mean by that is, what is that choice actually protecting you from? Now, you might hear me say that and be like, nothing. Nada. That sounds loco. You know, what do you mean? I don't want that. I don't want that. I want somebody who's available. Of course I do. Why would I choose that? And yet our behavior is suggesting something else. And so we have to, again, our kindness, grace, compassion, love, as we inquire about this. But when our behavior, right, is choosing something, then we know that there's an operating system, right? That is not in our minds, right? Like, we have to really shift kind of out of that, because it doesn't make practical sense to us. It doesn't make logical sense to us. Things don't seem rational to us. And so when we get caught there and we're like, this doesn't make sense, it's like, it does, but you're trying to think your way through it instead of really kind of connecting to a very different form of intelligence, if you will. And so, yeah, what is it protecting me from by choosing someone who is emotionally unavailable? Okay, so a couple of things. Maybe there's a fear of, if I were to choose someone who were actually available, I have the possibility of needing to be vulnerable, and I don't know how to be vulnerable. Mm. Or if I choose somebody who is actually available, then my risk of falling in love and really getting close to someone and then getting hurt when I'm further down the road is more likely. Or if I choose somebody who is emotionally available, then I might need to actually reveal myself to them. Or, right? Like, I mean, this list can go on. And I think, again, what is it that I am protecting myself from through this choice, right? And so, you know, when I talk about the wounds in the book, worthiness, belonging, prioritization, safety, and trust, what I'm describing is the origin stories, the first experiences that really lay the foundation and sort of change our trajectory in the way in which we relate to the self and others and the world at large through that lens. I described worthiness just a little bit before. Belonging, right? A sense of, okay, can I, Gabor Mate talks about how our two lifelines as kiddos are attachment and authenticity. But when attachment is threatened, we will trade authenticity every single time. So survival, we have to. And so a lot of times people will grow up in a family system where, okay, this is who we are. This is how we operate. This is what we believe. You have to adapt and adopt that. Otherwise, you're out. And so it can be a family system that's really controlling. It's where the black sheep of the family maybe comes out. If you became the rebel at some point, there might be sort of the sense of like, I don't fit in here. Even though fitting in and belonging are different, right? It's like, I don't feel like I fit in here. I don't feel accepted here. I don't feel seen or heard or understood or comprehended here. And I have to change who I am in order to, quote unquote, belong.
Belong.
Right? Yeah. And so we lose our authenticity a lot of time with a belonging wound. Prioritization. pretty straightforward, where you didn't feel like you were an important to the important people in your life. So maybe you had a parent or adult in your life who was a workaholic, someone who struggled with addiction. Maybe you had a sibling who had mental health challenges, and a lot of the attention went there. Maybe there was high conflict in the relationship and that was the priority. Maybe there was a divorce and mom started dating quite a bit and her dating life was the priority over you, right? Like there's a lot of things that can play out to where it is we don't feel like we're the priority. So you think about present day, okay, how do we show up in relationships? Are you someone who over prioritizes everyone else as an attempt to teach people and show people and model to people the way in which you want to feel prioritized? Do you choose a partner who, even though it doesn't have to be apples to apples, let's say you had an alcoholic parent, but now you've chosen someone who works late every single day, right? That there is something else that is a priority in their lives and your experience is one in which you are feeling deprioritized, right? And so we're looking at the ways in which we partner with people where our wounds are actually getting rubbed up against. The trust wound, right? So also pretty straightforward, where there's a rupture in trust. This can be, you know, an infidelity. It could be, you know, a parent gambling away a college fund. It could be family secrets. Those are big ones that we hear a lot of, whether it's you holding one or someone in the family holding one from you and you finding out about it later. And it creates a hypervigilance. It does the same thing with safety when there's an absence of safety, right? It's like it turns us into this hypervigilant individual who's kind of scanning our environments and waiting for the other shoe to drop or waiting for something bad to happen. Or, you know, maybe you got the message growing up that you can't trust men,
right? Anybody,
period. Right. And it's like, and now you struggle with that narrative and it's really hard for you to move through the world, believing people, trusting that they're not lying to you, trusting that they're not deceiving you, trusting that they're caring for your overall well-being, right? And so when we look at these origin wounds, a lot of the time we're going to see that the unwanted pattern present day is really connected to that.
And so as you so beautifully articulated these five wounds, I'm guessing many of us, myself included, can say, yeah, yep, yep. Do we all have these in like a different weighted average as part of being human?
Mm-hmm. I would say that, so I have some folks who will reach out to me and be like, is it possible to have all five? It's possible
like,
to have all
sure,
five. Yeah,
sure.
Absolutely. And I think there's also ones where there's like a primary origin wound, right? I have struggled with worthiness. I've struggled with trust. I've struggled with safety. Prioritization and belonging are not ones that really ring the bell for me as much. And also, of course, like the human experience, there can be moments in time where maybe we don't feel like we're belonging or we're feeling really lonely or we didn't feel like a priority to someone in an acute event. We're not talking really about the one-off moments though. We're talking about the things that repeat over and over and over again. Of course, when someone doesn't prioritize us, most of us are like, ah, that kind of stung
that sucked
yeah. You know, right? But it doesn't necessarily take over for us. Wounds, your resolution will take over more, right? It will be where we can't get over it, right? It'll be where we really struggle deeply with it. And again, those patterns are not going to play out if we don't have your resolution around a wound. The pattern really only plays out when there's your resolution there, when there's still work for us to do. And, you know, the work... Listen, it's not like a follow these four steps and you're done. You know, it's like this is not a, you know, Vogue article from 1990. But our work, which I do dive obviously much further into in the book, is about naming what our wounds are. It's about being able to witness ourselves. And so when you were talking about seeing that little girl, that first grader who, you know, went through a lot. And
baby Vienna.
Baby V. Yeah. Right. It's like there's a witnessing that has to happen there. I'm a really big believer that you can't heal without witnessing. Witnessing has to take place. And whether that is witnessing with self, so I'm seeing myself, or whether that's a therapist witnessing you, or a partner witnessing you, or a dear friend witnessing you, it can be anyone. It doesn't have to be the person who put the pain there in the first place. So thank goodness for that. But witnessing does need to happen. And when we witness, what it does is it leads us to grief, right? Which is just the authentic expression of emotion that comes forward when we are in this space of witnessing. And I guide people through all of this. But my big belief is that, you know, maybe you've heard the Viktor Frankl, it's attributed to Viktor Frankl, the quote about between stimulus and response, there is a pause, right? And in that pause is a space where we have the opportunity for freedom. And when we're doing this work, what I believe happens is that we are extending the pause. And when we're extending the pause, what happens is we're giving ourselves an opportunity to choose. And that's what I said at the beginning of our conversation, is that healing is about moving from survival to choice, right? And so when we're doing this work to understand, oof, here's how I'm activated, here's how I'm triggered right now, or here's the red flag, or here's the pattern, oof, I see it. Oh, this person, I like want to keep pursuing them, but I know that they're emotionally unavailable. Like I can see it, right? They're not responding to me. They respond with, you know, one word answers. Maybe when we go on the date and I ask questions, they don't really want to go there. You know, they're never actually setting up the next date. I'm the one who always has to do it, and it takes a couple of weeks. Right. It's like all of those things. And like, okay, we notice those moments. And so then we're like, okay, but what do I know? Well, I know that my worthiness wound gets activated here a lot, and that I have historically believed that my worth is dependent on somebody else choosing me. And so I keep chasing this person to try to get them to choose me. If I can just convince them that I'm great, if I can just get to the fifth date, then they'll become emotionally available all of a sudden, whatever story we might tell ourselves. And so when we're doing this work and we can understand, oh, this wound wants to grab the wheel. But I've spent the time, I have processed, I have grieved, I have witnessed, then I can stand there and I can choose, I have the opportunity to choose differently. And we still might not always choose differently in the moment, right? Sometimes it's just about the awareness. I always say, like, healing isn't always about the outcome, right? Like healing is sometimes like, I see my worthiness wound and I'm still going to pursue the emotionally unavailable person. You know, it's like, all right, that's okay. That's part of the titration, right? To moving in that direction. But if I can start to acknowledge this, if I can start to name this, right, then I have more of a possibility and chance to choose differently and to get to the place where, you know, where I described when you asked me about the catalyst in my life, which was, yeah, this is hard. And there wasn't like a big celebration afterwards. But here was this moment in my mid-late 20s where I was finally saying, I am bothered by it. I am affected by it. This isn't okay. I don't feel respected. And I did it differently. And I was able to do it because I had done this work that I'm describing, that I talk a lot about in the book. And listen, big gulp, big breath, because it's not easy work, and it doesn't just happen like this. You know, I'm speaking about it very quickly, but it's, you know, this is lifetime work, but it's beautiful lifetime work, because it's the work that gets us to the types of relationships that we crave, the way that we want to see ourselves in relationship. Or this isn't just about attracting a certain type of partner. This is about liking ourselves in relationships, liking the way that we communicate, liking the way that we navigate conflict. Gosh, I can still be a point prover. Let me just lovingly call myself
point prover. I love it. You're like, I have an affliction. It's called
I want to be right. And I remember having a conflict with my husband before it was my husband. So spoiler alert, it worked out, but still I'm having this conflict. I have no idea what the conflict is about, but I'm proving my point up and down, doubling down, tripling down. He's like, I gotta be, I understand. And I keep going. And you know, the shame hits for a moment. And then I replace it with curiosity as quickly as possible. I'm like, oh, to be right was really correlated and connected to what it was like to be a kiddo watching gaslighting and manipulation happen over and over and over again. Mm. Being right was quite literally safe. Being wrong was unsafe. My dad was right. My mom was wrong every single time based on his perspective and his ability to do what he did so masterfully. And so to be right in conflict was safety for me, except my perceived safety was disconnective and damaging to a relationship. And I just, again, very quickly share that story because our work in this is not just, okay, how do I fix my picker and, you know, get
right.
Like, how are we showing up in a way where other people also want to be with us? Because that's not great to be a point prover all the time. That is not, I don't think anybody wants to be with a point prover all the time and around that. That's not nice to be around. And so it's not about shaming myself or guilt tripping myself, but it is about looking at that part, understanding where it came from, bringing some compassion forward, and then working with it so that that part is not in the driver's seat, so that I am in the driver's seat and I can navigate that differently.
And you can take that pause, to your point, Vienna, instead of, with our clients, I call it, you can choose in that moment to respond versus react.
Yeah.
And so you, while we talk about picking partners that are better for us, our work is also being a better partner. And you're right.
100%.
This is about the work, and it's continuing to self-titrate through, yes, through all of it. I mean, I can tell you, as having been married for 27 years, it's a constant, mm-hmm, it's a constant evolution. But the good news is that when you continue to, I don't think we ever get to the point where we can just stop holding up the mirror, right? Even when we get better, sometimes it feeds that, like, wow, let me look, what was my role in this? Like, right, could I have been better, right? But being open to that growth, and to your point, which I love, it is, you can witness it, but then you be compassionate, mm-hmm, about it. I did the best I could in that moment versus going, God, I'm an idiot. Right. I blew it again. I just messed this up. I mess everything up, because that's so damning at the, mm-hmm, end of the day. So looking and speaking to yourself like you would speak to your best friend. So important.
Yes. Thanks for saying that.
Yeah. We're so not good at that sometimes, myself included.
I know, it's easy to get lost in that, but that's the work, right? To bring curiosity and compassion forward, you know, when we have access to it, to try to have access to it as much as possible.
Well, I know I could talk to you for another 10 episodes or 10 hours, but let me ask you two questions. Number one, is there anything I didn't ask you that you would like to impart to smart daters? And if yes, drop. And also, where can we get more Vienna? Tell us about the book. Tell us about all of the things you.
Yeah. Well, I think you were saying this before, which is, don't forget about your own experience in the dating process. Again, a lot of times we're really conditioned to try to get others to want us, choose us, desire us, pick us, etc. And we lose track of what it is that we actually feel and what it is that we actually want, and whether we actually like this person or are interested in a second, third, fourth date with this person. I would also say, and I said this before, but it's worth reiterating, is that change will ask you to tolerate discomfort. And we have to get willing and capable of doing that, because moving in the direction of the things that you say you want will likely require you to disappoint some people. It will likely require you to end things and when you normally don't, you know, it's like, it's just like the gut punches. And so to be able to begin to tolerate that and trust that in your expansion of the tolerance is actually you moving in the direction of what you actually want and say you want. Okay. Where you can find me at Mindful MFT on Instagram. You can find me at viennafarron.com, newyorkcouplescounseling.com. I have a group practice where we are in person in New York, but we also service a lot of other states as well. So if people are looking for therapists, I have a wonderful crew. And yeah, the book is called The Origins of You, How Breaking Family Patterns Can Liberate the Way We Live and Love. It's deep work and really beautiful work. And there's a lot of storytelling that I do in the book, which I think is a really great way to learn, because sometimes when we're looking at our own selves, we're a little bit more prickly, but when we're learning through other people's stories, right, it's like, oh, I can see myself, or I can see this part in someone else. And so sometimes it can be a gentler invitation into self-reflection and self-inquiry. So I hope that people will pick up a copy and start reading or listening today.
Oh, we'll put it in the show notes for sure. So thank you so much for spending this time with us. I feel a little more expansive after this. So
great.
Super awesome. And smart daters, remember, continue to look at yourselves and this process, and continue to know, and I want you to take this, you guys know, be psychotically optimistic about the fact that love is out there for you, and a better, happier love than you have had. So I want you to have a little kick in your step and know that we have sprinkled this good juju on you for this week. And until our next episode, thank you for listening. And thank you for being here, Vienna.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. And as always, download us, share us, show us the love. Follow Instagram at Smart Dating Academy. And if you or someone you know wants to learn more, check out our website at smartdatingacademy.com. We're here to bring you love.